From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Hillary Clinton's had a tough year, fending off a primary challenge that no one saw coming, running against a candidate who's so unusual. Oh, and people don't like her or trust her.
Hillary Clinton's unfavorability rating hitting a new high in a poll out today.
Only 11% find Clinton trustworthy.
When you ask for the one word that describes Hillary Clinton, a bunch of people said liar.
She's got to be used to it by now. After all, she's spent most of the last 25 years fending off ethical and legal challenges, ranging from the legitimate to the totally bogus, all premised on the idea that she always has something to hide.
What's Hillary Clinton hiding? New details today in her use of private email.
Lawmakers are trying to get the truth from Hillary Clinton on the 2012 attack in Benghazi.
Hillary Clinton answering questions about an Arkansas land deal and about money that she made on cattle futures when her husband was governor.
Before the Clintons left their governorship in Arkansas, more than 100 people had been suspiciously murdered.
And you know there's one today.
What's that?
Leading drudge. That she was wearing an earpiece last night.
That's Washington Post national political correspondent Karen Tumulty. And she's referring to Wednesday's Commander-in-Chief Forum on NBC, where Clinton and Trump were interviewed by Matt Lauer.
The only explanation that Drudge can come up with is that someone was feeding her the answers to the questions. Because really, can you think of any other reason why a person on live television would be wearing an earpiece?
For those who don't know, it's pretty standard. But the point is, Hillary must be up to something. Hillary's hiding something. It's a media reflex that Tumulty says was set in motion by a single decision almost a quarter century ago.
It was December 11th, 1993, at the very end of what had been a very chaotic first year in office for Bill Clinton. And the question of a failed real estate investment that they had made in Arkansas in the 1970s and 80s was once again percolating in the press, this being, of course, now famous as Whitewater.
The tangled relationship between an Arkansas land deal, a savings and loan, and Hillary Rodham Clinton's former law firm is again under scrutiny today.
We have the late Ann Devroy, an incredibly well-sourced White House correspondent for The Washington Post, had heard that the White House had compiled all the background documents on Whitewater. So she wanted to see them for herself. And finally, one Saturday morning, David Gergen and George Stephanopoulos, both of whom were working at the White House at the time.
You describe them as rivals who agreed on almost nothing, but they did agree on one thing.
They thought that the White House ought to just hand over the documents. If they allowed the media to take a look at it, that they would, A, see that there was nothing there, and B, get bored with it and move on to something else.
Right.
But there was a lot of resistance from the first couple, and particularly from Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was not in the room, it should be said. But Stephanopoulos, who knew them both very, very well, said that he could really hear the president channeling her arguments that, no, if we give this over, our enemies will just demand more. They'll never stop coming at us. And Stephanopoulos later wrote that if a genie were to come to him and give him one day back at the White House where he could undo one day, that would be the day. Because by not turning over these documents, they kept the controversy going. Within a month to the day, the White House had to agree to the appointment of a special prosecutor. That special prosecutor later became Ken Starr, and he was given all the powers of an independent counsel, which led to the discovery of Monica Lewinsky and President Clinton's impeachment for perjury and obstruction of justice, none of which were related to the original question of whether there was something funky about this real estate deal.
You could argue that Hillary had been under attack from the moment she emerged on the political scene alongside Bill in Arkansas for her looks, for her independence, her presumption that she knew stuff and could do stuff, right?
All of that is true, but she has an inherent tendency towards secrecy. For instance, when she set up the healthcare reform task force and had 500 people working on it, she refused to disclose the identities of those 500 people. She makes these kinds of decisions throughout her career, right up into her decision to set up a private email server. And almost always, this backfires on her. There's a little bit of irony here because Hillary Clinton's first experience in Washington was working for the House Judiciary Committee's impeachment inquiry of Richard Nixon.
Right.
And after Watergate, there were a number of permanent changes in both the law and the Washington culture. After Watergate, you had a much more skeptical press. You had a number of new tools originally used by the left to sort of force issues where corruption was suspected. The Clintons also arrived in Washington at a moment where scalp hunting had become a real sport.
You describe that an entire industry grew up around the Clinton scandals, pseudo-scandals, conspiracy theories. Were the Clintons, as a political couple, so different that they would warrant this kind of scrutiny?
Some of the ways in which they did business made the problem worse. For instance, by 1996, we are all embroiled in campaign finance scandals over a number of policies that the White House instituted for fundraising for the Democratic National Committee, where if you wrote a big enough check, you could spend the night in the Lincoln bedroom, or you could come to a coffee in the map room where there would be regulators present who regulated your industry. I think we also need to add into this the changing media environment, the internet coming up as a real force. Matt Drudge, I think none of us had ever heard of him before the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
And here he is still at it this week.
Exactly. But suddenly, there are forces out there that can drive information and put it in the hands of people without going through the traditional media filters. And some of that information was valid, but a lot of it was not. And that included rumors talked about in the darker corners of right-wing radio and on the internet that accused the Clintons literally of murder and drug running.
But does some of this have to do with the fact that the Clintons, by dint of their generation, forced an increasingly divided culture to confront itself?
That's another ingredient to throw into our witch's brew here. As one of their longtime friends and advisors said to me, you know, it was basically sex and drugs and Vietnam, and Bill Clinton had it all. And Hillary Clinton herself, when her back was against the wall, would come up with explanations for things that just weren't plausible.
So do you think if she had just been able to fully disclose the Whitewater documents and been more transparent in general, that she could have prevented the kind of intense scrutiny that she's experienced since, the suspicion that she just can't be trusted?
I think it would have been possible to avoid some of it. People like George Stephanopoulos and David Gergen believed that had they turned over the Whitewater documents, Ken Starr would never have been appointed, and Bill Clinton would never have been impeached. Would there have been scandals and fake scandals and rumors? Yes. But nothing of the magnitude that we saw come to pass.
Is it too late for her to change the narrative now?
That is a very good question. The lessons that she has learned from this, the lessons that a lot of her supporters think they've learned from this, and the lessons that the people around her have taken from this are the exact opposite. That, you know, the best defense is a good offense, and that you dig in and get ready for trench warfare.
It's funny, people say she's fake, switches from one thing to another, but in this, she's been quite steadfast.
That is true. My very first cover story that I was writing about her for Time magazine was when she was turning 50. She is a very, very difficult subject to humanize because she can be incredibly charming and funny off the record, and then the minute you open your notebook, the gates come down. And so I was out to dinner with a bunch of reporters with her on a foreign trip, and it was off the record, and she told an absolutely charming story, which was about Chelsea going off to college that year and how she missed her so much that she would just sneak into her bedroom and just sit there and mourn her absent daughter. So one day she's sitting there in the bedroom and the other door to it opens and in comes the president, and it turns out he's been doing the same thing. I said, could I please have this on the record for my Time magazine cover story about you? And her office said, absolutely not. She does not talk about Chelsea on the right. And I said, you know, this is about Chelsea's bedroom. She doesn't even live in her bedroom. And so all was for naught until a few days later, I did a phone interview with the president. And I knew that if I asked one leading question, he was going to drop that story on me so fast. And he did. And so I was able to use the anecdote because Bill totally understood what I was going at here, which was just one kind of humanizing little anecdote. And she is just so defensive on stuff like that.
So this trust issue between Hillary and the media, it's just a downward spiral. It just keeps growing on both sides.
Yeah, but the fact is, I think every reporter who has had any chance to see her in an off-the-record setting knows that there is another side to her personality, but something about her refuses to let that side show.
Karen, thank you very much.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Karen Tumulty is national political correspondent for The Washington Post.
Hillary Clinton and her supporters have been fighting the dishonest narrative for most of the last 25 years. But it's got to be particularly galling this year when the person she's running against lies with such frequency and brio that only his favorites, the most repeated, even make it into the news.
I saw people getting together and in fairly large numbers celebrating as the World Trade Center was coming down.
When you hear 4.9 and 5% unemployment, the number's probably 28, 29. I even heard recently 42%.
His grandmother in Kenya said he was born in Kenya and she was there and witnessed the birth, okay?
He's only just backed off that one. But Trump's flagrant disregard for the truth, coupled with the fact that his supporters don't seem to care, has led pundits to declare that we have entered a new political era, that is...
We are now living in this sort of a post-truth campaign.
It seems to be the post-truth election in a lot of...
Post-truth political world. Donald Trump is the poster child for it.
You could put my voice in there, too, because when have we ever seen its like? To which freelance journalist Sam Chris says... Forever?
If you go back to Plato's Republic, he complains that the citizens of his time are swayed by theater and by their emotions. They're not interested in this kind of universal standards of objective truth. And he's very worried about that. He thinks that all political power should be invested in philosophers because they're people whose only job it is to find out what is true.
Men sitting around a circle in togas 3 millennia ago may deal with similar subjects. They weren't in a similar environment. There were no mass media. And organized politics was an extremely elite endeavor. Can you look closer to our place in history where the similar kinds of arguments were taking place?
I think the closest analog would be the time around the French Revolution, where you had a great deal of worry in a lot of places that you had demagogues who were kind of stirring up a restive population, essentially with lies. Edmund Burke, for instance, in his Reflections on the Revolution in France, condemned many of the radical preachers of his day who were, quote, using their pulpits not for the diffusion of truth, but for the spreading of contradiction.
You also cite John Stuart Mill.
I do, yeah. I mean, John Stuart Mill, obviously, as a liberal, believed that people should be able to say and believe what they want. However, he did draw certain boundaries. He and Alexis de Tocqueville, for instance, were very worried about the great 19th century terror of the mob, with a capital M, the mindless masses of the people. One of his great examples is that it is one thing to say that all property is theft, but not when you're leading a mob at the gates of a rich man's house.
you wrote in your piece that, quote, whenever political processes start to involve large numbers of people, there's a worry that truth is being abandoned. This ought to say something. What should it say?
I guess it would say that from the perspective of a ruling class, people who are trying to disrupt or overthrow that are always going to be figured as agents of some kind of untruth. There's always been this kind of worry among certain elites that democracy will always resolve into kind of mob rule. In the ancient world, there was this schema of political orientations. You had autocracy, which was good, and then tyranny, which was bad. You had aristocracy, which was good, and oligarchy, which was bad. And then you had the republic, which was good, but democracy, which was absolutely considered to be an evil.
The fact is, we are facing election day where 40%+ of the electorate seems to be embracing a guy who has engaged in constant hate speech, who has pronounced policies that, in the most generous terms I can say possible, are extra-constitutional. Is there nothing remarkable about this historical moment?
Yeah, I believe that there is. I mean, I think we're in a moment of a great intensification of processes that were already latent in the democratic constitution of the United States. We're in a time of very significant turmoil, but I wouldn't say it's necessarily historically exceptional. There's always a kind of violence and a demagoguery and a hatred that can express itself through democratic politics. You know, well into the 20th century, you had mass segregation in the South. Trump is displaying this kind of politics at a time when it can reproduce itself instantly and endlessly through new forms of media. But the kind of politics he espouses, I don't think they're necessarily an entirely different creature.
And one of your complaints is that by obsessing over the constant assertions that are demonstrably wrong, those who would fight a demagogue are missing the point and doomed to fail.
Yeah.
If not fact-checking and truth-squatting, then what?
If you're confronted with a political evil, the best response is not to kind of grumble or quibble that it's getting its statistics wrong, but to fight it with something actually good. And if people who oppose Trump want to not just prevent him from getting into the White House, but to actually build a better world for us to live in, then we need to start thinking about that kind of thing rather than obsessing over facts and data and statistics.
Okay, you've just told me why litigating political speech strictly through the prism of actual truth and falsity is kind of a pointless exercise. But are you also actually advocating some degree of untruth?
I mean, I'm not advocating the practice of lying to people, but the power that politics offers is to think of something that doesn't exist, something that under any kind of very strict definition would be considered untrue, and decide that you would like it to become true. You can dream of universal suffrage. You can dream of a national health service. You can dream of a communist utopia. So I think the question is what kind of untruth we want.
Mint Twizzlers.
Sorry?
I'm sorry. I'm just dreaming out loud. It's a candy. Sam, many thanks.
It's been great being here.
Sam Chris is a freelance writer. You can read his article, The Biggest Political Lie of 2016, at Slate.com.
Coming up, what ails Fox News? The wolf is gone, leaving chaos behind.
What ails Roger Ailes? I get it. This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Earlier this week, former Fox News host Gretchen Carlson accepted a $20 million settlement from 21st Century Fox in her sexual harassment suit against Roger Ailes, Fox News founder and former CEO. When news of the scandal broke in July, Ailes swiftly denied it all while riding a wave of support from the Fox News Rat Pack.
I've worked for Roger Ailes for 20 years. Best boss I've ever had. Straight shooter, always honest with me. 95% of the people who have worked for Roger Ailes would say exactly the same thing that I just told
Similarly, Greta von Sustern and Jeanine Pirro told the New York Times they have long-term working relationships with Ailes and said neither had witnessed the kind of behavior claimed by Carlson.
But Ailes' star power was no match for the facts. By late July, Rupert Murdoch and his sons James and Lachlan, who run Fox's parent company, told Ailes to take his $40 million severance deal, poor Roger, and to not let the door hit him on the way out. Gabriel Sherman, Ailes' biographer and national affairs editor at New York Magazine, this week reported that Fox News host Megyn Kelly and 18 other women also were sexually harassed by Ailes. In his cover story, The Revenge of Roger's Angels, he details how Ailes built a culture of fearful compliance at Fox News.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that Rupert Murdoch has made him so successful over the years is that he's hired executives that are really willing to go to almost any lengths to produce profits. And what that does is it ends up encouraging a lot of corporate misbehavior.
Because Murdoch gives his favored employees, his profit-making employees, such a long leash, they basically can shape their organizations any way they like. Fox is 20% of Murdoch's profits? That's a lot.
That's correct. It generates over $1 billion a year of profit. Rupert Murdoch is a newspaper man at heart. That's where you got to start. He did not know the television business. Ailes understood the medium, and so Murdoch trusted him to run Fox News as he saw fit. And it's important to understand what Roger Ailes built at Fox News was not a news network, but it was a political operation. A lot of the people he recruited in the early days at Fox were veterans of his political consulting company, Ailes Communications. And the culture of Fox News from the very beginning in 1996 was one of a political campaign where loyalty was paramount. Leaks to the press were punished with ruthless severity.
You talk about how they got the personal home and cell phone records of Joe Strupp, a reporter for Media Matters, the liberal watchdog group, because Strupp apparently had some insiders at Fox giving him information. You also describe a TV system within the building that allowed Ailes to monitor all of Fox's offices, studios, green rooms.
Yeah, he used the network's resources to build a surveillance operation called the Black Room inside of Fox News that was staffed by operatives and political consultants. The public relations department at Fox News was built both to monitor the employees and even leak damaging information if Ailes felt that they were being disloyal, but also to target people outside the network.
Didn't he collect a 400-page dossier on you?
Yeah, as CNN has reported, there was a dossier created about me and fake websites to smear my reputation. And he hired private investigators to follow me and my wife.
At some point, worried that people would start connecting the dots about his behavior, he had a wall built around his office so that people couldn't see who was going in and out, and also had people change the visitor logs?
Yeah. And when the investigation was going on into the sexual harassment, when Rupert Murdoch's lawyers were trying to prove these allegations, they could not confirm in some cases that the women were in Ailes' office because the logs didn't show that.
Well, let's talk about the culture of misogyny at Fox that he created and normalized.
I mean, all you need to do is watch the channel, the way women are pressured to dress. Rudy Bakhtiar, who was a Fox correspondent, told me about how she felt uncomfortable wearing the mini skirts, and she actually asked not to, and producers said, well, Roger wants to see your legs. You also notice on Fox News that the desks are glass on many cases, so you can see their legs. So again, this was all part of the production to highlight the sexuality of the female talent on the network.
Which is why there's something kind of delicious in the fact that with all this control and all this surveillance, Gretchen Carlson must have at some point determined that turnabout was fair play.
Exactly. After Gretchen Carlson was demoted off of Fox and Friends in 2013, she started bringing her iPhone to meetings with Roger Ailes and capturing these comments on tape to prove that this harassment was going on. We should point out he has completely denied any of these allegations, even after more than two dozen women came forward to speak to the law firm Murdoch had hired.
Even after he was caught on tape?
And after Gretchen had taped him, he has denied every single allegation.
So let's talk about his legacy, and let's begin with Trump. You suggest that Ailes laid the stepping stone for his nomination.
Yes, Ailes gave Trump a weekly call-in segment on the morning show Fox and Friends, and he really helped mainstream a lot of this conspiracy talk that Trump and the far-right websites like Breitbart were fostering in the Obama years. And by giving Trump that platform and by offering him political advice, Ailes was instrumental in fueling Trump's rise.
And this is where it gets a bit complicated, because Trump and Murdoch didn't get along. And so you get a situation as during that early GOP debate, the Fox interlocutors were pretty tough on Trump. Mm-hmm. And most notoriously, Megyn Kelly's famous citing of Trump's sexist remarks back to him.
You once told a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president? And how will you answer the charge from Hillary Clinton, who is likely to be the Democratic nominee, that you are part of the war on women?
What the drama of last summer at the GOP debate showed was that Ailes' rule over Fox was slipping. A few weeks before the opening debate last summer, James and Lachlan Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch's two adult children, were promoted to co-leadership positions, effectively becoming Roger Ailes' bosses. And both the Murdoch sons have a lot of antipathy to Trump, James especially. So they were not happy with Ailes' boosterism of Trump. And so Ailes was caught between his own personal political project and pleasing his corporate overlords. And then caught in the middle of this triangle was Megyn Kelly, who had a lot of ambitions of her own. And so this complex mix of agendas exploded onto the screen last summer when Trump began attacking Megyn Kelly.
You've spoken to Fox employees since Ailes' ousting. How's the network doing?
By some admissions, it's chaos. Even before Ailes' ouster, I had had Fox executives describe the climate if Ailes ever did leave as a, quote, Lord of the Flies situation. And we're actually starting to see some of that. This week, Greta Van Susteren, the longtime Fox News anchor, she had been at the network for 14 years, abruptly resigned from the network. She had publicly defended Ailes.
Yeah.
And had cast doubt on Gretchen Carlson's allegations. And so when she learned the full scope of his alleged behavior, I understand from my reporting that she felt betrayed, and when she couldn't renegotiate her contract, she basically said, I'm out of here. Sean Hannity has been so openly pro-Trump, and as the New York Times reported, advising Trump behind the scenes, that there's a lot of speculation that if Trump ever did launch a television network after the election, if he loses, that Hannity would be a founding member.
Is there any evidence that Trump is planning to launch Trump TV with Ailes at the helm, or is this just the stuff of media journalists' dreams?
Well, talking to people in Trump's inner circle, I do know they talk about it. He travels the country turning out thousands and thousands of people. He clearly wants to try to make money off of those people. You know, it bothers Trump. He wants to turn this audience into some sort of business if he can, if it's not the presidency. As to the Ailes question, you know, part of his severance from Fox News includes a non-compete agreement. He can't work for a rival television news or media company through 2017. He could be an informal advisor to Trump and sure, maybe take some role after. And knowing Ailes' ambition, I think whether it's Trump TV or something else, he's going to try to have another act.
You wrote that by merging news, politics, and entertainment in such an overt way, Ailes was able to personally shape the national conversation and political fortunes as no one ever had before. That it's not a stretch to say that Ailes is largely responsible for the selling of the Iraq War, the swift voting of John Kerry, the rise of the Tea Party, the sticking power of a host of Clinton scandals, and the purported illegitimacy of Barack Obama's presidency. They couldn't have done it without him?
Without question, he catalyzed and drove all of those news events that you just described. And we can just take the Iraq War. We go back to those months after 9/11 and we remember how American culture became swept up in this hyper-patriotism. And Roger Ailes is at the center of that. Fox News' ratings exploded in those months. The success that Fox was having pushed the entire media to the right. The entire media was on notice about seeming liberal and being scared of being against the Bush administration. It all originated in the White House, but Ailes was in constant contact with Karl Rove and Dick Cheney and others. So it was all part of one system that helped sell and package this war.
Gabe, thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Gabriel Sherman's latest story on Roger Ailes appears in this week's edition of New York Magazine. He's also the author of Roger Ailes' biography, The Loudest Voice in the Room.
Coming up, a news consumer's guide to Islamophobia. Long overdue.
This is On the Media.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick made headlines recently for a profoundly American gesture of free expression that many saw as perversely un-American. As a protest against racism and police brutality, he refused to stand for the national anthem. This created the predictable talk radio furor and, inevitably, this week, led to the ultimate question of someone suspected of hating our freedoms.
Rumors began to swirl after Colin Kaepernick's first national anthem protest on August 26 that the 49ers QB had converted to Islam. On Wednesday, Kaepernick addressed the religious conversion rumors.
He does have a strange last name, and he is suspiciously olive of complexion, but no, he isn't Muslim. Alas, the question is far more revealing than the answer, and the fact that the media entertained it is dispiriting in a zeitgeist sort of way. On this 15th anniversary of 9/11, the stereotyping and very often vilifying of Muslims and Islam in the media and in the public mind adds to the grim roster of victims every single day.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
And so, for the anniversary, we offer the Breaking News Consumer's Handbook, Islamophobia Edition. 10 tips for processing the week's media output with limited damage to the innocent, to understanding, and to truth itself. We begin with a really solid first step when you encounter the words Muslim or Islam in the media. Find and replace.
So Glenn Beck has, I think it's his latest book. It's called It Is About Islam. Not a very clever title, but fine.
Journalist Haroon Mogal is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Policy and a member of the Muslim Leadership Initiative at the Shalom Hartman Institute.
If you replace Islam with Judaism, he sounds like a Nazi. If you replace Muslims with black people, he sounds like a Klan member. And if the reasoning is wrong when applied to one group, then it should be wrong when applied to any other group. No group of human beings can be reduced to a single thing, period, not one.
Beware especially of dog whistles. Is Muslim being used as an epithet?
Barack Obama's father, who abandoned his family, was a Muslim who eventually turned atheist. Then his mother married another Muslim, moving young Barry to Indonesia, where he was exposed to the Islamic world, even though...
Do terms like radicalized or fanatical or war on terror get invoked about domestic abortion clinic bombers and white separatists?
So, for example, recently in Massachusetts, a man was arrested for stockpiling weapons to kill police, Muslims, and President Obama, and we call him a Massachusetts man, or we call him by his name.
Linda Sarsour is executive director of the Arab American Association of New York and co-founder of the Muslim online organizing platform Empower Change.
When Muslims are the accused or alleged perpetrators of violence, immediately we understand their faith, who their religious mentor was, whether or not they went to mosque. We only choose to tell the faith of a perpetrator when we know that they are Muslim. If they are of any other faith, that doesn't seem to be a piece of identity that we want to share with the rest of the world.
Whatever that identity might be, Muslims are not a homogenous group with a single shared culture. Arab Saudi Arabia is not Arab Syria, is not Indonesia, is not Turkey, is not Somalia, is not Canada. Any more than Catholic France is the same as Catholic Croatia or Catholic Colombia. Religion scholar Reza Aslan is a professor at the University of California, Riverside, and author of multiple books on the history and politics of Christianity and Islam.
Nobody refers to Colombia as a Christian country, and so therefore the problems with drugs and with gang violence have to do with Christian culture. That's in ridiculous statement. And yet one would, without flinching, say that Nigeria is a Muslim country. And so therefore the problems of violence and instability have to do with Muslim culture.
Furthermore, Aslan says, national or regional culture is not the same as religion. Stoning adulterers and female genital circumcision are actually regional cultural practices, not Islamic.
Neither of them exist in the Quran. And yet, there are Muslim-majority countries that practice both of those, but do so because it is embedded within the culture of those countries. And indeed, there are Christian-majority countries that also, for instance, practice female genital mutilation.
Confusion for news consumers is understandable. In broadcast coverage, you could easily be thrown by exotic imagery like the call to prayer, women in hijabs, and so on. It's so, you know, foreign. Here's another opportunity to find and replace. Are Catholics routinely covered taking communion, kneeling in prayer, being sprinkled with holy water? Or when the subject is terrorism, think of the Oklahoma City bombing coverage. Was it filled with American flags? That is, once they determined it wasn't committed by Muslims. No, media outlets assume a perpetrator's Christian faith is irrelevant, which is why in the first reports of the slaying of three young Muslim students in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, by a white American, the murders were attributed immediately to a neighborhood disagreement.
A developing story in the shadow of the Chapel Hill, North Carolina University. This afternoon, police say a dispute over parking is behind the murders of three people there. The victims are Muslim.
Not a radical parking dispute, mind you. Only days later did the religion, or a religion, of the atheist white suspect find its way into the coverage. So, after a violent crime involving a Muslim suspect, ask yourself if speculation is too reflexive. And if that process endangers the innocent or simply tars them.
And people are going to start being even more suspicious of their Muslim neighbors. So ordinary people, doctors, teachers, cab drivers, the guy who delivers your mail in the morning if he happens to be Muslim.
Millions of Americans living under an accusatory glare because if they aren't actually wearing explosive vests, don't they maybe sympathize with terror?
Can I just point out that it would help greatly if moderate Muslims, people who are looking down on all this, say something. If you know something, just tell someone.
Muslims are the ones that see what's going on. The Muslims are the ones that have to report them. And if they don't report them, then there have to be consequences to them.
First of all, if you're looking for Muslim outrage about terror acts, just Google it and set aside some time. It is a vast trove. Secondly, says Haroon Mogul,
moderate Muslims suggest that Islam is itself a problem and the majority of Muslims are not moderate.
Which he says is not only a slur, but a ridiculous accounting.
If you look at a group like ISIS, right, ISIS is 30 to 50,000 members, probably. Even the maximum estimates I've seen are 100,000. Out of 1.5 to 2 billion people.
But most telling, says Mogul, is the chauvinism implied by the term moderate.
moderate Muslims are the few we can talk to and approve of because they have the right ideas. And they're the right ideas because their ideas are basically our ideas.
Our ideas, notably excluding the dreaded Sharia law.
Those who hold firm to all of Sharia's precepts believe stoning women for adultery, cutting off limbs of thieves, and killing those who abandon the faith are still acceptable forms of punishment.
To have Sharia as institutionalized law, as governance, is very dangerous.
Sharia law is a sort of operating manual for the Quran, in much the way the Talmud and its halakha law are an operating manual for the Jewish Old Testament. Oddly, nobody quakes about Jews sending us all back to the Middle Ages. And by the way, physician, heal thyself.
If we have an imam here who wants to impose Sharia law on the United States, this is an imam who has no regard at all for the doctrine of separation of church and state.
Predominantly Muslim countries are suspect for being theocratic, but large swaths of our electorate and a big chunk of the U.S. Congress support a biblical influence on our laws, from same-sex marriage to teaching of creationism to prayer in schools. Do not let the shrillest voices dictate your level of fear. Even when the subject is jihadi violence, take a breath. You're more likely to be killed by a white Christian or your spouse or your bathtub than you are by a Muslim stranger. As in so many aspects of understanding the world, take in the big picture. Whether in the stock market, sports, or geopolitics, single-factor analysis is reductive and misleading. In political Islam, the political, authoritarianism, human rights abuses, economic instability, and remnants of Cold War realpolitik, is at least as significant as the Islam. And then, finally, there's this.
Whenever we're talking about Muslims as a political issue, for whatever reason, we don't seem to talk to Muslims themselves.
Golf coverage turns to golfers for expertise. Medical coverage turns to doctors. Where are the Muslims? When at the Democratic National Convention, Khazir Khan stepped forward to denounce Donald Trump, Mogul says it was
the exception proving the rule. Generally speaking, though, when Trump makes comments about Muslims, when he makes comments about immigrants, we hardly ever hear from the people who are going to be affected by the proposal. When Trump talks about Syrian refugees, for example, how often do you actually hear Muslim people talk about the issue?
For the sad answer, watch cable this week. Or, better yet, don't bother.
Now for Islamophobia abroad. This week, in regional elections in Germany, an anti-immigrant party vaulted from zero into second place, pushing Chancellor Angela Merkel's party into a humiliating third. One of their slogans is, "Islam doesn't belong in Germany." The human face of Germans' fears may look something like this. Three Syrians in a park outside a refugee home, smoking dope.
My English is not very well, but
Nah, thanks.
That's WNYC reporter Ilya Meretz turning down a smoke. He says there's an unusual effort underway by one TV station to give new immigrants the tools to blend in, if it's not too late.
I don't take the dope, but I do make chit-chat with these three Syrians, two guys and a woman with nothing much to do. Mohammed, who speaks some English, says, don't get the wrong idea about us.
Some hashish, not a lot of hashish.
No judgment. It's
What
she said?
He wants the hashish for forget anything.
I'm pretty sure what he's saying is they smoke up to forget the horrible things they saw at home. Mohammed fled Aleppo, worked in Turkey for a year, learned the language, saved money, and then made the journey north. And he's ambitious.
Right now I can't work. I have to study right now. I'm going to technical school.
Already?
Yeah. After that, I have to make Ausbildung. Ausbildung.
An apprenticeship. He wants to learn machine tool automation.
After that, I can work.
To a lot of Germans, Mohammed and his friends look like a security threat, or even a threat to national identity. A recent study found more than 4 in 10 Germans would like to stop Muslims immigrating to their country. So perhaps the last thing those Germans would want to see is this guy, suddenly appearing last fall on their TV screens and mobile phones. He's fair-skinned, wearing a leather jacket, extremely smooth chin, looks like he just stepped out of an ad for a razor. In every way, he also looks just so German. But he's speaking Arabic. He says, "Welcome to Germany. This is for the Syrian and other Arab refugees coming here seeking freedom, safety, and a better life. In this program, I want to tell you about life in our country." And he goes on to explain some of the basics. We Germans generally work from around 9 in the morning to 5 in the evening. We value our free time. And when we come to a red traffic signal, we always stop. This is Konstantin Schreiber, Germany's only Arabic-speaking TV news anchor. And that last thing he said, it offended some people.
I received a lot of hate mail because of that, because people were saying I'm a racist, because I think people from the Middle East don't know what a red traffic light is. To which I can comment that if you have ever been to Syria, you know that traffic lights are a mere decoration rather than something you have to obey.
So here's a man uniquely positioned to be a bridge between 80 million Germans and hundreds of thousands of new arrivals, many of them Muslim. He's a Berliner who's worked in Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, and the Gulf states.
I'm a correspondent for RTL, which is Germany's biggest entertainment channel. But in September last year, I launched Germany's first Arabic language program, specially dedicated to better educate Arab refugees from the Middle East who started coming to our country.
The show is called Marhaba, or Hello, and you can think of it like a user's guide to Germany. Chapter 2, The Constitution and Sharia. Chapter 5, Love and Sex in Germany. Chapter 17, Hair, in which Schreiber takes a newly arrived Syrian stylist, Fahad, on his first visit to a German salon. I see lots of women who shave the sides of their head, Fahad says, not looking very impressed. I've never seen that in Syria. Schreiber says the point of the show is to demystify Germany. No question is too silly.
We received really hundreds of emails from people who were saying, "Oh, Germany is a very nice country, but all those stray dogs, they're bizarre." To which I have to say, well, they're not stray dogs, they're pets. Yeah.
How did this show begin? How did this come about?
I was on parental leave in September with my wife, and you're sitting there, you can't go out in the evening, baby sleeping, so you watch TV. And it was the beginning of the mass migration of the refugee crisis in Germany, and we were watching these talk shows, and there were old German men talking to each other about, well, refugees should know our constitution, they should know our traditions, and we were saying, well, they can talk forever, they will never notice, yeah?
At this point, Schreiber's wife gets an idea. "Honey," she says, I'm paraphrasing, "you can help the refugees assimilate.
Well, you speak Arabic, you can address them directly and tell them something about the political discussion we're having, our expectations." The following day, I proposed that to my boss, and she said, "Well, that's an interesting idea, go ahead."
That was a Monday, about a year ago. The following Friday, they uploaded the first episode of Marhaba. And overnight, Schreiber says, it got hundreds of thousands of clicks. Today, the show has been viewed more than 4 million times online. And while plenty of Germans I spoke with have never heard of it, Marhaba is clearly reaching its intended audience. Listen to what happens while we're crossing Alexanderplatz, right in the center of Berlin.
Those guys just recognized you.
Okay. We have Syrian refugees, probably.
Two young guys in street clothes. They do this big, obvious double take and smile.
That happens all the time, that the people pass by and say, "Well, I watch your show online. Cool thing. Wow, what an online program can do."
Of course, Schreiber has made enemies, too. He gets death threats and plenty of hostile messages.
They are saying you're paving the way for Islamization of the West. I'm saying, no, I don't talk to them in Arabic to make Germany becoming more Islamic. I'm talking to them in Arabic to make them more become part of our society. Yeah.
When I first watched him on video, I had Schreiber pegged as a journalist who's really into Arab and Muslim culture. But he says, "You read my motivation all wrong. I do this because I'm scared for my country."
I mean, what we're seeing already is that our society becomes more gewalttätig.
Violent.
Violent. Just the show today, the talk show that we were doing, it focused on domestic security. And we were talking to weapon dealers from Germany who told us that they were selling 300% more weapons just in the first 6 months of this year compared to the entire year 2015. There is an ever-growing number of people doing martial arts, not because they think it's a sport, but to defend themselves if needed. So I'm very worried, yes? I don't want my kid grow up in a world full of weapons. I know you have a different approach in the US, or more diverse approach to that, but I grew up here in Germany, in a country where you would consider there are no weapons, and it has already changed.
Since I spoke with Schreiber when I was in Germany back in June, there have been a number of unrelated violent attacks all around the country committed by refugees and asylum seekers. In one week in July, there was an axe attack on a train that left four injured, a machete attack in which a pregnant woman was killed, and a suicide bomb which injured 12. Immigrants have been attacked as well, though that doesn't always make the headlines. Over the summer, the national mood has further soured toward immigrants, and the most recent episode Schreiber recorded for his show seems to reflect that. The attitude of playful cultural exchange is gone. Instead, the episode is a somber commentary, an urgent admonition. It's titled, Learn Our Language, Learn Our Culture.
WNYC's Ilya Meritz. This reporting was supported by a Holbrooke grant from the International Center for Journalists.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Michael Lowinger, Sarah Kari, Paige Cowett, Noah Kernis, and Leah Fetter. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Holford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.